G'day you mob, how's it going? Welcome to this episode of Aussie English. This is a special three-part series, okay? So this is going to be one episode in a three-part series where I interview my dear friend Marcus Kane. Marcus, or Muzz, as I know him, and I went to school together and grew up really good friends all throughout high school. We hung out a lot, we did music, and we also did a lot of working out and fitness-related stuff over the past probably two decades or more now. So I decided to get Muzz on the podcast to talk about a few topics, including what he's been doing for me and my weight program, my goals, everything like that. We talk about nutrition and eating disorders in the second episode, which is a sort of specialty that he deals with his clients, helping them overcome things like bulimia. And then in the third one, we talk about social pressures on men in particular to look a certain way. So things like bodybuilding, celebrities, movies, and the use of illicit drugs or steroids. A lot of these drugs aren't necessarily illegal, but there's a sort of shady side to it. So we talk about that as well. Anyway, without any further ado, guys, let's get into today's episode. I give you my strength and conditioning and nutrition coach, Marcus Kane. Let's go. G'day guys, welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today I have Marcus Kane, who is a strength and conditioning and nutrition coach. On the podcast today, we're going to be talking about nutrition and eating disorders, and we'll sort of touch on a little bit where we left off in the last episode. This is going to be a three-episode series where we were talking about learning about strength and conditioning and my plans, what I've been doing with you. We didn't sort of get too deep into it, but Muzz, welcome to the podcast. How are you going?
Good, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Man, it's so funny. We're wearing the same clothes as last time, in the same position, everything, right?
I know, right?
It's almost like we recorded this directly after the last episode. sorry, dude. So it's great to have you here again. Let's continue on from where we left off. Let's start with, we can talk a little bit more about what I'm doing after we start with maybe what should someone do if they are a complete novice and they're thinking about improving their strength and conditioning. What's the sort of basic advice that you would give to people? We were talking about that, what was it called, the preparedness, like basic...
General physical preparedness. So we'd be looking at things like full body movements, whether that be things that utilize the Olympic bar, like the squat, bench and deadlift. You know, things like pull-ups, sled work, like sled pulls, sled pushes, medicine ball slams, all those just like really big movements, push, yeah. Pull, drag.
And so when you say that, you mean like it's using a lot of your muscles and a lot of your body at the same time. It's not just a bicep curl or a tricep extension. Yeah. You're using a lot of your muscles in conjunction with one another to do these large movements, which are going to really, what would you say, like reinforce the messages that go between them and the strength and the way that they work together.
Well, it just builds full body conditioning. Not just muscle strength and size, but we're looking at connective tissue strength, you know, conditioning of tendons and ligaments and connective tissue. Because, you know, if we try and get strong, but our connective tissues aren't up to scratch and don't have the strength to support the movements that we're doing, then we're going to get injured. Central nervous system adaptation. So our body's ability to perform a bunch of work and then positively recover from it, in order to then train again and keep going. So things like the isolation movements and the beach muscles and the bicep curls and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. How well we do with that hinges on how well we go with our general physical preparedness and our fundamental strength.
I'm just going to take my jumper off because it's getting brutally hot in here. Hold on a second.
All right. Take it off.
Sorry, I hope I didn't blind you there with my white stomach.
Dude, I live in Wales. Like, what are you talking to me about complexion for? Have you seen me? It's snowing outside. It's snowing heavily.
I've never seen it snow. I've seen the snow, but I've never seen it snow. I've never seen the actual snow falling down.
Can you see that at all? Like,
I'm not sure that the camera is good enough to the sky is kind of blowing it all out. So we were talking about, what you should do with strength and conditioning if you want to get into it. You were talking about these big compound movements. But before that, I guess there's a step of where should someone go? Because I'm sure that there is a lot of content online that they can get access to, but that's not necessarily the best thing to do. Just go online and be like, here's a few tutorials. All right, I'm going to go to the gym with my new knowledge and just bash out a few sets. What's the best way that you should address that, especially if you're someone who's maybe, late 20s, 30s or 40s, where they should be thinking a lot more about longevity and health into the long term and avoid injury?
Yeah, I think if you're really serious about what you're doing, the best thing to do is wherever you can avoid generic information and get some mentoring. I'm not talking about personal training, because most personal trainers just kind of clock in, clock out, and they don't know shit. There are some really good ones out there, but it's very easy to find very charismatic personal trainers who don't know shit. So, you want to be looking for someone who's achieved the results that you want to achieve. They're completely transparent about their use or potential use of any performance enhancing drugs. And again, it's hard to find that kind of transparency because so many people use them and then go, I don't use them, but whatever. Then
we'll get to that in the next episode.
Yeah. But then also you want to look for someone that, if you want to get some information, you want to get some guidance, a good sign is someone who's going to ask you a lot of questions, who's really going to be genuinely interested in you, your goals, your workout history. They're going to want to see videos of you doing certain movements. They're going to be very thorough and they're going to be very invested in you personally. When they talk to you, they're only talking to you and they're talking specifically to you. And again, they've got a lot of questions. They want to know a lot about what it is that you're doing. Integrity is kind of what you're looking for. And yeah, so because getting generic information online, there is some great information that's available for free online.
Yeah.
But if you're really serious about what you're doing, then you're going to need to talk to someone who's got all those things that I just mentioned.
I think also you have to kind of foster that interest and thirst for knowledge when it comes to working out and training. If you're going to be a sort of meathead who just wants to get big and get epic gains, but you don't actually want to understand how the movements are going to help you do that or how the training is going to help you do that, you're going to need someone who is literally in the know, doing all of your workouts with you and telling you what to do.
Which is expensive.
Exactly. So if you actually want to be able to do this on your own, I think that you just have to maintain that curiosity and interest and understand why you're doing certain movements. What are you trying to achieve? I see a lot of people when I was going to the gym quite a lot before getting my home gym so that I didn't have to because of COVID. It seemed like there were always a lot of people in there who were doing things that they had no clear idea of what the reason for doing that movement would be. And they were doing it incorrectly where they were probably going to injure themselves. And it seemed to me, I didn't obviously interview these people about it, but it seemed to me like they had very, very little training and very little interest in understanding the training. They had instead just come to the gym and they just see the machines and they think, oh, I know what to do. There's a little image up on here. I can see that he's doing this movement. I'll just think I do the same thing and bam. And I was always like, man, I wish I worked here so that I could tell some of these people, like, be careful, Jesus Christ, like, stop doing what you're doing and get someone to tell you. So I think my biggest thing here is, for me, I was always trying to get information from other people at the gym or personal trainers like yourself that I knew. But then if I was going online, it would always be to kind of supplement the real information that I'd gotten in real life, where I was like, okay, I actually want to understand the deeper workings of, okay, I'm doing this movement because I want XYZ, but why is it giving me XYZ? How is it working? And then I would go and try and find that out. And it becomes interesting, right? You kind of have to foster that thirst and that interest.
Well, if you're not genuinely interested in it, you're not going to be able to stick with it long enough to get the result that you want, especially if you want, and I mean, if you want like a specific result, a very specific change, very specific body change. And one of the most valuable things that a good coach can do is to help filter information for you. So you say about research and developing an interest, That's absolutely fantastic. The difficult thing is, though, that there is so much unregulated shit information out there. So it's almost like your coach doesn't just play the role of, you know, coaching you and providing you with information. It's that they can, it's that you can take any information that you find and run it by them and go, hey, what's the deal with this? What, like, is this on point? What do you, whatever? And then they can go either yes or no.
That reminds me so much of my jiu-jitsu training back in the day when I was doing that full on. You know, I was going and working out and then doing 1 or 2 hours a night in jiu-jitsu for like 5 years and was just going nuts with it. But I remember I was getting so deep into the online tutorials for the different techniques that you could do. And yeah, you would take them to class and be like, oh man, this is totally going to work. It's going to be so good. No one's going to know what hit them. And you would ask, you would show the coach, and it was effectively you shit testing it, right? And being like, is this going to work? And sometimes he'd be like, that's fucking sick. And other, but yeah, most of the time he would be like, that's complete shit. That would never work. This is so dumb. Whoever taught this was doing it on a willing, you know, participant who allowed them to get the move. Like, so yeah, it was good to have him as a filter. My coach, who was always here, Tiago, shout out to Tiago.
Yeah,
it was amazing. Very humbling, I think, though. But yeah, otherwise you end up just, you know, thinking you've learned all this helpful stuff and it doesn't work in the real world, and worse, it could injure you.
Yeah, 100%. Same deal.
Man, so let's move on to nutrition and eating disorders. Do you want to talk a bit about how did you end up sort of moving in that direction? Because I always thought of you as a strength and conditioning coach from when I knew you from a young age.
Yeah.
What made you so interested in nutrition and eating disorders? Because, you know, the last time I checked Instagram, it seems like you can eat whatever the fuck you want and you'll get shredded.
Well, essentially, I developed an interest in solving problems pertaining to nutrition and disordered eating, specifically bulimia and binge eating disorder, because I suffered with that for the better part of 15 years as a result of information that I found through the commercial fitness industry and through some really, really shit uninformed resources and people who I went to for help when I first started training in my teens. So essentially, I wanted to get certain results that I was seeing in magazines and whatever, because, you know, I'm 1,000 years old. We had magazines back then, not Instagram. And yeah, I was looking at these images in magazines and everything like that. And I was like, yeah, cool, that's what I'm aiming for. But I didn't realize at the time that all those fuckers were using steroids, like literally all of them.
Sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, we had that conversation recently where I totally had the carpet pulled out from under me. It's like someone telling you that, you know, the Easter Bunny doesn't exist. You're just like, wait, what? Yeah. But I remember talking to you and you're like, no, duh, man, they're all on drugs. That's how they get into the magazines. It's like impossible to get that and be that lean. And we'll talk about this in the next episode. But yeah, I was like, wait, what? These guys aren't legit? Like, but it says they're legit and it shows their training program and their nutrition. And you're like, yeah, and there's a blank page where the drug use is.
Well, essentially, yeah, that was one of the things that led me to develop a very serious eating disorder myself. Like, I'm 6 foot tall and at one stage I weighed less than 60 kilos. Like, so I'm around 180 centimeters tall and I weighed less than when it was at its worst, I weighed less than 60 kilos, around 58 kilo or something like that. Oh, wow. And how that happened was I started off training, watching my diet and all that kind of thing. And I felt like I was looking at how I looked, looking at how I was training, looking at the pictures in the magazines, looking at myself in the mirror and thinking, I still don't look like that yet. I feel like I'm working hard.
Yeah.
But in order to look like that, I must need to train harder. I must need to train more. And I must need to be stricter with my eating. So I kept being more and more strict with my eating and my nutrition while continuously increasing my training volume, increasing my training intensity. And when it was at its worst, I, for my school lunch, I would take maybe a sandwich, but I was the only kid in our school drinking black fucking coffee to suppress my appetite.
I remember thinking, like, you were a total weirdo at the time, being like, man, no one likes that shit.
That's the thing. I was a freak at our school. One of the things that really kind of drove that process is, like, sure, I did get a six pack. And then The moment I got a six pack, a few of the girls that I thought were really cool at the time said, oh, look at that. Like, Marcus is going six pack. So I'm like, huh, whatever I'm doing is working.
Yeah.
So I kept going, and it made my eating disorder worse. It made my obsession with training worse. As a result, like, I became extremely emotionally unstable. Like, I was always anxious, always in a bad mood, because I was fucking starving all the time.
I remember, you had a bit of a short fuse at times, and it wasn't too difficult to set you off.
Upset me? Yeah. I was always hungry. I was always tired. Like, because I was getting up at, you know, even as a teenager, I was getting up at, you know, 5:30 in the morning to go to the gym before school. I was training after school. When it was at its worst, I was like living on black coffee and almonds and the occasional chicken, and it wasn't a good time. I was doing cardio training and swimming training and whatever the school required me to do in the morning, and then I would go home and lift weights in my garage. And, you know, I would do that in Australia in summer, so I'd be there in on a 40 degree day in a garage with a tin roof. It would have been, you know, 45, 50 degrees in there, and I'm in there lifting weights, and I just like, and I was doing all that to try and be as good, to look as good, to measure up to the people who I was seeing in magazines, not knowing that they were actually using performance enhancing drugs. And the thing with nutrition was, like, I just kept restricting my food. I kept looking at these guys who you could see their muscle fibers through their skin. They were just ripped all the time. I was like, what? Like, it's crazy. I must need to eat even less to look like them. And it just, and because I didn't have any good mentors around me, I didn't have anyone to really show me the way or tell me the truth. It just got so bad to the point where, after you starve a body for that long, there's a physiological starvation response that kind of kicks in, and kind of like the animal parts of our brain start to freak out, thinking that we're starving, and they start to trigger these urges to binge eat. Like, where I literally remember, like, the first time I picked up a piece of, like, I was playing a show with the band that I was working with at a New Year's Eve party, like, when I was about 16, and I was just so hungry. And of course, it was a party. There was all this shit food there, just like cakes and whatever else. And I was just looking at this cake. I'd been starving myself for months, and I just desperately wanted this piece of fucking cake. And I, the moment it hit my taste buds, the moment, it was like I couldn't stop. It was the craziest feeling. I couldn't stop. And I just kept eating. And the next thing I remember after that is like, I was hanging over the side of the, we were out on the end of a pier, on a pub that was on the end of a pier. So I was out over the side of the pier making myself throw up. Between sets with the band, because I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I just ate all that. Why did that happen? And I started making myself throw up. And that was where the pattern of binge eating and that was where the bulimia started, because then I would experience these uncontrollable eating episodes because my body was starving and it couldn't hold off anymore. And then I would feel so guilty and so terrible. I would feel like a failure and that I wasn't worth shit as a human being if I didn't have abs and all this kind of stuff. I'd make myself throw up. And then something that really made that situation even worse was the commercial fitness industry kind of rhetoric of like, you can have a cheat day. I read this book by this fucker who I've found out was since on performance enhancing drugs. And he was saying that, yeah, like, and he wasn't the only one saying this. There are a lot of them out there. I won't name him because I'm not interested in causing issues, but he's a fucking prick. It was saying if you're really good and you stick to this diet or whatever through the week, you can have your Sunday where if you want to eat two burgers for lunch, eat the two burgers. You can eat whatever you want. And I was like, oh my God, are you fucking serious? Enter the cheat day, which was essentially a planned binge that happened on a Sunday where I took that so literally. I would eat so much food that it were like unfathomable amounts of food, just crazy amounts of food. I would start with like fucking nachos at 6 a.m. in the morning because I would wake up early.
There's only 24 hours in a day. We're going to get this done.
I would wake up early and I would wake up so excited.
Yeah.
And like I would binge eat. Yeah, I'd be better than Christmas for someone who's fucking starving to death. I had a doctor at one stage tell me when I was like really, really, like when I was like less than 60 kilos, like, look, if you don't stop doing this, if you don't stop losing weight, you will end up in hospital and you could die.
Mm.
Like, so, you know, in trying to get me to eat more, they gave me this book, which was from this bodybuilder who told me about the cheat day.
Wow. So that was not helping either then.
Yeah. And so then this cheat day became this thing where I would binge for a day. And my brain, like I've now long afterwards learnt how our brains work a bit more in regards to foods and how certain parts of our brains register patterns and we develop triggers and all this kind of thing. And I developed this crazy trigger with food that like to try and it got to the point where I was like, okay, what I'm doing on Sunday, it's crazy. I can't keep doing this. I don't like it. I feel awful. And when I tried to stop, it was almost impossible to stop. Like I would try and stop myself from binge eating and the urge to binge eat would just drive me crazy. It was all I could think about until I gave into it. And that's when, yeah.
So, there's probably going to be, based on statistics, and you'll know better than me, there's probably going to be someone listening to this who has bulimia or, you know, some kind of eating disorder. How do you pull yourself out of that situation? Because you obviously now are very healthy and, you know, knowledgeable about this experience. And thank you for being candid and sharing this with us. I'm sure it's not easy.
Yeah.
But what did you do to get yourself out of that hole that you were in? And what do you suggest to anyone listening who may have that sort of an issue?
It's to describe it, rather than it being like a step-by-step process that's the same for everyone, imagine it more like a web that starts in the middle and goes outwards. There are a couple of things that are in the center that are absolutely key that everyone, you know, if we want to break that pattern, that everyone has to do. And then depending on the person, the individual, and the certain situations, then on that next level of importance, there are like other things that some might apply to you, some might not, depending on your history, depending on how you developed the pattern of eating or the disordered eating that you've developed. So it's like we start with the absolute essentials and work our way out. One of the just primary essentials to start breaking that pattern, there's almost like we want to think of it in terms of there's our mental game. So the way that we need to reframe things and start thinking about things mentally and practicing certain mental processes. And then there are very practical processes like, okay, we need to be eating a certain amount of food. That's non-negotiable. That scares a lot of people who are in patterns of disordered eating, because sometimes the idea of eating more food is terrifying. And there are other people, there are people online and people claiming to provide support that are doing the best they can, or they're doing what they think is right, but they're not actually helping because they're painting this picture that in order to recover, someone needs to gain a lot of weight. Now, again, this is all dependent on the person. Obviously, when I weighed 58 kilo, that was absolutely true for me. When I was that underweight, yeah, I needed to gain a good 20 kilo to be back with 60, 70, 80. Yeah, I'm 20 kilos heavier now than I was then. You know, so I needed to gain 10 kilo to be in a good place again. But then some people who try and force weight gain on people, it's so complicated in some ways, and it depends on the individual, because the idea of gaining weight in the name of recovering from this process or breaking this pattern is terrifying. That's why there needs to be one-to-one conversations. We need to hear each other with this kind of stuff. And this is what I do a lot of. People talk to me about their personal situation, and I work with them to find a way out of it that suits them best and works, you know, pushes their comfort zone a little bit, but isn't so fucked and isn't so outside of their grasp that they just can't do it.
The seat is impossible, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're going to train for a marathon. I've never run. Ah, screw it. We'll just do 20 Ks on the first day. You got this.
Push yeah. Hard. It can be crazy, but you know, One of the first fundamental steps is sending that signal to the body that we have the food we need. It's all right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're not going to, another example I use is like, if you're riding a horse or if you have a pet horse and you want the horse to take you somewhere, but you're starving the horse.
Yeah.
The horse obviously being our body in this situation, the rider being our conscious mind. If we're starving the horse, the horse is not going to be a good fucking horse. The horse is going to be all fucked up. The horse is going to not have much energy. The horse is going to have a weird temperament here and there. We need to communicate with that horse, with our body, by feeding it well, that everything's okay. Once we've started to nourish the body using specific foods, then we as well at the same time start to work on our mental practices, because in some ways some of us have dealt with this cycle of eating for so long that it's been hardwired into our brain. We've learnt it like a skill, like a habit. So we need to consciously do things to break down that habit, to break down that pattern, so the subconscious parts of our mind don't continue to just drive us in that direction. So there's the food element of it and the nourishment element of it, and there's the mental game aspect where we need to consciously retrain our mind.
So what does the road to, you know, normality look like for a lot of the people who come to you? Obviously they come to you and they're in a bad spot and they tell you about their situation. Is it the kind of thing where the majority of people, if not all people with this sort of an issue, can get over it if they have the right sort of advice and if they do the work and genuinely want to change and improve things? Or is it a just, you know, like a once an addict, always an addict kind of thing where it's really difficult to kick long term?
That's a big question. The recovery, the most clinically successful, as in the methods that have produced the best success or the most reliable success in kind of clinical trials and measurable trials for disordered eating at this stage, I think cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the things that has proven to be more successful than other techniques. However, don't quote me on this, but the last statistic I heard was it has a 50% success rate.
Yeah. That's actually pretty high, I would imagine, compared to someone trying to, say, get off heroin or stop smoking, if that's correct, as you say, you know, that's...
Yeah. However, there are other methods and there are other elements that, like, cognitive behavioral therapy did not help me.
Yeah.
Like, I throw that statistic out there in regards to CBT because it's a measurable statistic and it exists. But cognitive behavioral therapy did not help me. Mentoring from strength and conditioning coaches and athletes who'd been where I had been and recovered successfully, that's what actually helped me.
What did they tell you? What was the kind of stuff that you needed to hear?
It was it's a big combination of things. One of them being, like, you know, a guy who saved my life in many ways was a mentor who I went to in regards to training at first. Now, I specifically chose this guy to go to because I was struggling with my training at the time. I wasn't getting the results that I wanted. I was injured. I was in pain. And what I thought I needed to do was just causing me more and more pain. This guy was in his 50s and his physique was just brilliant. He was happy. He was healthy. He was not injured. Yeah, his physique was great. And I was like, mate, what are you doing to look like this in your 50s, drug-free? And he kind of took me under his wing and mentored me a little bit. And one of the things that he just said really kind of candidly, like when we caught up for our first chat in years, he said to me, like, mate, you look like you need a feed. You know, like, and hearing that from someone who was an athlete that I admired, that I trusted, who was also a friend, who I knew, he knew my goals. I had a lot in common with him. We had a lot of common ground. We had a good rapport. Like, he understood me.
And probably had your best interest at heart as well, right? It wasn't a judgmental. Get some food up here, you thin bastard.
Yeah. Hearing that from him helped me in ways that years of therapy never did.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that people should not see qualified therapists. That is not what I'm saying at all. So nobody jump on me for saying that therapy is not, because, like, absolutely therapy is valuable. But I think something that works exceptionally well is a combination of therapy, counseling, psychotherapy, whatever you want to choose, and actually getting some mentoring from someone with integrity in the fitness industry who knows how to deal with those situations for someone who does have body goals.
It's interesting how the same thing could be said from a lot of other people, but it wouldn't have landed as obviously from him, right? And so it is so interesting that you're saying, you know, like, I tried all this therapy and I'm sure the therapist at some point was saying you just need to, you know, get a better relationship with food and have more to eat. But the fact that it came from him in a different context that actually hit home and made the difference shows that, you know, you need to obviously try a lot of different things and not necessarily just think this is the there's this one thing that I think will solve it, and I'm only going to do this one thing, and that's it. If it fails, it fails.
Yeah. I mean, it's to be honest, it's a combination of things. With no small measure of personal dedication that allowed me to recover from it, to not only to recover from it, but be in a point now where I've created a program to help other people. And that is my job now.
Yeah. Which is I still do some.
Yeah. Well, I still do some strength and conditioning training for a couple of people, but mostly my job now is working with people who are trying to break patterns of bulimia and disordered eating.
Do we have the inverse kind of issue as well? Because, I mean, obviously it's clear, especially for women that, and well, for both, right? Obviously there's women who look up to these women who are models or just see advertising everywhere, and these women who seem to have these impossible to obtain figures. And that ends up pushing them towards, say, anorexia or binge eating or bulimia. And then on the male side, you have it from men trying to look like these guys that are, you know, in superhero films and in magazines and everything. And I've forgotten where the question that I was actually going to ask was going. Oh, is it on both ends? So we obviously have it where people have this, you know, unhealthy attitude towards food when it comes to trying to get the body they want. But then it seems like we're also in this obesity crisis where people on the other end of the spectrum seem to have no problem eating food at all, but they're eating the wrong kind of food.
I think so, you'll find they do. Like the people on the other end of the scale who might struggle with their weight.
I guess what I was trying to get to is, can we talk a bit about the way in which society seems to, as a whole, have a very unhealthy relationship with food and the sort of, you know, causes behind a lot of these things, whether it's obesity or anorexia?
Yeah. To be honest, we could unpack that box for days. it's an exceptionally complicated subject. You know, there's genetic elements, there's social elements, there's, you know, like the combination of you know, genetic and social factors that contribute to someone's relationship with food. Like, how many different combinations of things can you create out of, you know, just a handful of variables? It, you know, and this is actually why I don't do group programs.
Yeah.
I don't run group coaching programs. I only do one-to-one coaching.
Because you end up helping no one, right?
If you're because I, the average. Like, maybe one day down the track when if I figure out a formula that I'm really happy with, I might do a group coaching program, but I only do one-to-one coaching programs to account for everyone's uniqueness in the combination of things that have led to the situation that they're currently dealing with. So in what I was going to say before, in terms of people who are struggling with their weight, like the fitness industry has a lot to answer for with that. And, you know, primarily people trying to make money from shit, scamming weight loss programs that don't work have a lot to answer for.
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because it's kind of like, here's a solution to your problem that we gain money from, but in the long term, we only really gain money if the solution doesn't really work and you have to keep coming back for more solutions to your problems, right? And so that's where you're kind of like, I feel like you're a bit of a drug dealer. And you're like, just have this one last hit and you'll be sweet. You won't have to come back. And then you're back here next week. And you're like, yeah, I kind of need it again.
Yeah.
Sorry, your video just went off there.
Someone just tried to call me. That's fine. So there was something that I was going to say just before that person called me.
The fitness industry having all of these, you know, quick fix solutions to dieting and everything, losing weight, they really only benefit maximally if it doesn't work long term and you have to keep coming back to get on more diets.
I got it. One of the most difficult things with that, and a tool that a lot of people with no integrity in the weight loss industry use, is the power of making the person who's doing the program completely accountable for their own results. Now, everyone should be accountable for their results. However, some of the people running these programs set them up in such a way that while you're working with that program, yeah, you do really well. But then the moment you leave the safety of that program, things start to fall to shit. And that breeds this feeling that, oh, it must be my fault. The failure must be with me. Yep. I wasn't able to keep this going. While I was doing the program, I was doing really well. But then when I was on my own, I don't have what it takes to whatever. And people start to think that that's a reflection on their level of success or their level of discipline or willpower or whatever it is, but it's not true. It's a very clever, darkly clever, but very clever manipulation. If someone...
A fine line, yeah, right? Like, it's a fine wire to kind of balance where, you know, I think that works in any kind of marketing system where you have people paying ongoing, and I have to be wary of this sort of thing when creating my products, because there are this sort of dark side of marketing and business that you can use, but it's just, you know, you have to have no ethics or morals to really go down that path where the person is getting suboptimal results or only gets results whilst they're paying you, and the moment they stop, they fail.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. And I've seen that with the fitness industry quite a bit, right? I mean, look at Jenny Craig is, I mean, not calling them out, but it's that kind of model where obviously they're only really making a lot of money as long as you're constantly on a diet eating their food.
Yeah. One of the things that I consider to be a great success for my own work and my clients is if someone does a 90-day program with me, like a 3-month program, 12-week program, whatever we want to call it, and then they never need to speak to me again other than to tell me how well they're doing, I fucking love that. Something that, like, it just makes me so happy. That like, my idea of ultimate success is someone only ever needs to pay me once.
This is the problem with Apple, right? One of the biggest problems is that all of them things that they sell you break within a few years, so that you have to buy the next model. And it's like, yeah, man, I miss when things weren't precision engineered to only work for a very, very sort of small amount of time, then break when the new thing comes out. You know, 100 years ago, when people made scissors, the scissors fucking worked forever because they couldn't they couldn't engineer them within, you know, a micrometer and say, well, the tolerance, it should work right now. And then as soon as it's out of warranty, boom, it'll break and they have to buy a new one. But it seems like there are so many things today, even plans, you know, things like dieting plans and that, where it's like these are so well put together to make sure that they fail the moment they need you to pay more money to stay on the wagon.
Yeah. And bringing it back to, you know, disordered eating or binge eating, bulimia, whatever we want to call it. Sometimes I'm quite aware of the language that I use because something that I do is I do my absolute best to provide a space where men who are struggling with this can feel cool about coming to talk to me about it and work it. Most of my clients are men.
Yeah.
Though if I go out online and start talking about eating disorders or disordered eating, most men hear that and see that and go, no,
even
I don't.
I'm guilty of that. Like, not necessarily me myself thinking of my own food. And I'm sure after speaking to you, I realized that I had an unhealthy relationship with food, hence being a little bit overweight. But like yourself, I had no idea that you were going through what you were going through when I knew you, right? I just thought you had a short fuse. And so when someone says, you know, men have health problems with eating disorders, I had that reaction where it was like, I didn't know anyone who's ever had that. I didn't see.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Where are these people? I've never seen a guy, you know, just going and vomiting. I see him drinking to the point where he's vomiting, but I've never seen him do that with you know, straight after a meal or anything, but it is there, and it's something that it is a shame that more men can't talk about it and address that sort of an issue.
The funny thing was, the only guys that really knew that I was going through that at that time were the guys who I was spending so much time with that I couldn't hide it from. These were the guys in the band that I played in high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I certainly wasn't perfect. To be honest, I was a shit friend to have as a teenager because of how messed up I was as a result of these things. I was not a cool, I was not a fun person to be around. But even so, you know, those guys saw what I was doing because I was always around them. And I was trying to hide it, tried to masculine my way through it. But I actually remember one day where I'd eaten something and I'd gone off to the bathroom to throw it back up, and one of the guys came in and knocked on the door and said, you know, dude, I can hear what you're doing. Do you want to come back downstairs? Like, and it still gets me to this day.
Yeah.
Because like, yeah, guys don't talk about it.
Well, we don't. I would imagine you didn't want it to be someone else's burden. So I would imagine
that position,
it would be something I'd be like, okay, I'm happy doing this to myself, but I don't want it to affect my friends and other people. I don't want it to be your burden.
Well, that's true. And as well, our value as men is often has a strong correlation with how independent and low maintenance we are.
Yeah.
Like the you know, if we need help or if we need, so, or if something's that, like, it's almost like, you know, the moment a workhorse on a farm can't pull its own weight anymore and becomes a burden, you know, back in the day that the horse would just be shot. They'd put the horse down. It couldn't be of any more use and they'd move on. And I think there's a pretty savage culture of that that's ingrained in men. And I think a lot of larger issues kind of radiate out from that essential value of, if a man can't meet certain standards, if a man can't fulfill certain things, if a man can't be what is maybe required of him or what he thinks he should be or whatever, then his value just goes right down. Like, if we look at the suicide rate, mm-hmm. in men in the UK, like, suicide I think is the number one killer of men in the UK under 50.
Yeah.
So it comes down in a lot of ways to, you know, if we're talking specifically with disordered eating, a lot of men get into that pattern because we're trying to fit a particular mold. We're trying to be what we need, what we think we need to be in order to be valued. But then sometimes hitting that target is actually physiologically impossible.
Well, it's interesting
when that happens.
You kind of said, like, you obviously had that issue initially because you were trying to, you were holding yourself up to, in comparison to these fitness models and people, you thought, you know, this is what I should look like to be a man. But then also we have this mental idea of what a man should be as well. So it's interesting that there's that the physical aspect, but at the same time, this mental aspect, and that these are kind of, that they fuse together in this situation with something like bulimia to be sort of almost more than twice as toxic as they would be on their own, right?
I'm sorry, you might need to rephrase that one for me.
You're holding yourself up to look at people physically, but then also you're thinking mentally, well, I can't actually talk about these issues. I can't be open about it. I can't look weak. So there's the whole emotionally, I have to appear to be strong despite not being, and physically I have to appear to be strong despite obviously not being so because of my diet and everything like that. So I was just commenting on how it's interesting that there's this interplay between the two things. It isn't just a physical issue and it's not just a mental issue.
Yeah, interplay. 100%. Both of those things kind of feed into each other. And it's why we see such a culture of binging in men. You know, we see a culture of binging in men and women, of course. But and I don't want to exclude anyone who's suffering from this conversation. But essentially, a culture of binging, whether it be in men or in women, binges usually happen, whether it be food, alcohol, TV, you know, people just sitting in front of Netflix and just switching off for days at a time. Binging culture happens when the cracks start to show in someone's coping ability, in maybe, you know, and when we talk about coping mechanisms, if someone comes to me and says, you know, why can't I do this or why can't I do that? My first question is usually, what are you expecting from yourself?
Mm.
What do you expect that you can achieve? What are you expecting from yourself on a day-to-day basis that is making you reach a point regularly where you just have to, like, whether it be alcohol, whether it be food, whether it be TV, whether it be whatever, what are you expecting from yourself?
I think
that's a huge question.
That's such a good point too, because we're in the social media age where now we see all of these perfect lives, you know, all these influencers online that we think are absolutely crushing it. They're doing so well. Yeah. They look so amazing, and you don't get to see anything of behind the scenes. And so it is this weird situation now where probably the majority of interactions that we have with people are now online, and definitely in my case, and it's such a distorted and skewed view of what other people's lives are actually like. That you know, you're kind of walking through, it's almost like this sick museum where you're seeing these fake fabricated paintings of everyone, and you think that's what the real person actually looks like, right? And so we're in this world now where even I'm the same. You know, I see people's videos online and they get millions of views and they look a certain way, and I think, fuck, if I just look like that and I, you know, did this, then I would have those views. And you know, it's so funny how you just have to try and be as aware as possible of the fact that what you see online isn't at all an accurate reflection of reality, right? And that a lot of the time, you know, you don't realize this person's on, you know, performance enhancing drugs, has probably taken 1,000 photos, has manipulated the lighting, has made sure that he has, you know, dehydrated himself to look amazing, and then only posts the photo when he's having a great time whilst on holiday in Greece, and says, you know, just living my normal life, you know, just working outside. And you think, fuck, that's that guy's life every single day, and he looks like that all the time. And you have to sort of check yourself, right, and be like, you know, there needs to be a disclaimer. May not be as expected below all of these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do we finish on a good note?
Well,
how are you going now?
To be honest, my dynamic with food is better than it ever has been. And as a result of repairing that dynamic, my results from my own training have become much, much closer to what I've always wanted them to be.
Yeah.
Like, I've got the kind of personality where I'm always kind of working on something, and I'm always setting that bar a little bit higher, which, I don't know. There are positives and negatives from that, but like
positives than negatives.
More positives than negatives. But yeah, like the thing is, so many people get so attached to patterns of training and nutrition that make them fucking miserable in the name of achieving a certain result. And I would want anyone who's in that place to know that breaking that cycle is not only possible, but it is absolutely necessary to achieving the result that you actually want.
Yeah.
Like,
otherwise, what you're kind of like getting pulled in two directions, right? The result you want is over here, but you're doing what you think you have to do, and it's kind of not getting you to either.
Yeah. I mean, when we get caught in cycles of destructive eating or obsessive training, it becomes like an emotional cycle. And again, some guys listening to this might think, I'm not emotional, I'm just being disciplined. I'm like, well, any decision that we make that's not based on you know, in regards to body goals, nutrition, whatever, any decision that we make that isn't based on the clinical research congruent with achieving that result, the result we want would be classified as an emotional decision because it's surely not a logical one.
Yeah.
Like I work with a lot of people who, when I say to them, you need to train less in order to achieve your, in order to train your, like, in order to get your optimal result, they're like, oh my God, but I can't. I'm like,
less is more. But,
yeah. But, you know, it's, you know, we need to be, yeah, to end on a positive note, it's like, what?
A great, sorry to interrupt you, a great thing that I've noticed, at least within the fitness industry over the last probably 5 years, is how much they now push quality sleep, which grateful because I never heard
up. Like, you know, being told that I should be able to conquer the world on 6 hours sleep was one of the things that led me to develop, you know, that exacerbated a lot of the issues that I experienced. So there is not only a way out of the destructive patterns with nutrition and exercise that someone might be experiencing or that you might be experiencing. If we put in the time and work and care necessary to make that happen, it is actually congruent with achieving the result that you've been aiming for the whole time and actually enjoying life. Because I missed a lot of opportunities and a lot of enjoyment from some times and experiences that I'll never have again in the name of having a six pack while I was doing it, which is fucking ridiculous. And that's not to say that, you know, if you want to have a six pack, you can't have a six pack or whatever, it's fine. But there is a way to do it that is miserable. And there's a way to do it that actually allows you to have a good life and allows you to have the energy available to you to enjoy having it.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's not only a way out, but it's actually necessary.
Well, man, thank you so much for talking so openly about this stuff, because I think we probably went deeper than we've ever gone before, to be honest, even in private. So I know it's a, you know, it's a big thing, and I'm glad that my listeners have the chance to hear about this sort of stuff, because it's hard to find this kind of a conversation, and hopefully it's going to help them. Where can they obviously contact you or find out more about what you do if they would like to purchase your services or get advice or send you a message or anything like that with regards to eating disorders and nutrition or strength and conditioning coaching?
Instagram is the best way to reach me still. So keeping it simple, it's M Kane Coaching. So at M Kane Coaching on Instagram, MKAIN Coaching. And, yeah, that's definitely the most reliable space to contact me on at the moment. And, you know, dude, thank you for the opportunity to chat about this stuff.
Man, it's my absolute pleasure. And, yeah, guys, thank you for joining us, and we will see you in the next episode. See you later.